Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. It's our morning talk program. My name's David Inge, and we are glad to have you listening. We're also pleased for this first hour of the show to have as our guest Jonathan Ellis. He is a permanent staff scientist at the European Center for Nuclear Research. That's in Geneva, Switzerland, and it is home to the world's largest particle accelerator. This is the Large Hadron Collider. It is expected to become fully operational later this year, and scientists believe that it will add greatly to our understanding of the universe. Our guest, Dr. Ellis, is here on the campus to talk about the kind of work that he and his colleagues there at CERN are involved in, talk about the collider, what it is they're expecting to do with it. He's giving a talk in the MillerCom series, and the title, Exploring the Universe with the World's Most Powerful Microscope and Telescope. And we'll talk about that in the course of the conversation, I'm sure. His talk takes place tonight at 7:30 in the Knight Auditorium of Spurlock Museum on South Gregory in Urbana. These events are always free and open to the public. The Department of Physics is the main host, but there are a lot of other people who have contributed to bringing him here, and we're pleased that he could be here with us, spend a little time talking. Questions are certainly welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, and we do also have a toll-free line, so if it would be a long-distance call, use that number, and the call's on us. That's 800-222-9455. Again, 333-WILL and toll-free 800-222-WILL. Well, thanks very much for being here.
It's a pleasure.
Appreciate it. As we were talking here just a little bit before we got going, I think my expectation is that probably most of the people who are listening to us will have no idea what a particle accelerator is or what it does or why you would want one. So I think the place to start is by asking some very basic questions, and maybe the most basic, and I'm sure we can go into some detail in different directions, but if I just said, well, what is a particle accelerator, how would you answer?
Well, perhaps we could start off with an even more basic question.
Okay.
What is a particle?
Okay. What is a particle?
So over the past century or so, we have understood what matter, the visible matter in the universe, is made of. So everybody knows that atoms, and inside atoms you have electrons going around a central thing, the nucleus. And inside the nucleus, there are smaller things, protons and neutrons, which in the first half of the century were thought to be fundamental particles of nature. Now we understand those are not actually fundamental, and the true elementary particles inside the nucleus are things we call quarks. Now, these quarks inside the protons and neutrons inside the nuclei and the electrons going around the outside, those are examples of the fundamental constituents or the elementary particles of matter. So what we're trying to do with our experiments, I might mention, by the way, in collaboration with colleagues here at the University of Illinois, is to try to understand better these fundamental particles, what they are, why they are the way they are, and how they interact with each other.
Well, then let me ask again a basic question. I think people of a certain age, you know, if they think back to what they learned in science classes and about what all of the things that surrounded us were made of, we were taught that everything was made of atoms, and there are different kinds, and people remember the periodic table with all the various elements, and there were different atoms, and the thing that was different as you moved up the table was you got more electrons, you got more protons and neutrons. But basically, and people, I'm sure, have in their head this model of it was like a little solar system. You have your nucleus, which is made of protons and neutrons, and then electrons are spinning around them. What was it, though? So, and at one point, as you say, the idea was that that was the basic stuff. There was nothing smaller than that. You couldn't go any deeper into the structure of matter than those three things. What was it that got scientists thinking about the very question of, well, is that really the basic building blocks, or can you go deeper? Why did they even start thinking about this question, well, are there things that are smaller than protons, neutrons, and electrons?
Well, what happened sometime around the middle of the 20th century was that people realized that in addition to protons and neutrons, a whole bunch of similar objects, and at first it looked like a zoo that nobody could understand. Mm-hmm. But people, as time went on, realized that you could understand the sort of systematics of these things. They were grouped into families. And these families could be understood if there were more elementary objects sitting inside the protons and neutrons, things that, as I mentioned, we call quarks. Now, there were some crucial experiments done at Stanford in California in the 1960s that established the reality of these quarks. And that was done by using a particle accelerator. So perhaps now is the time to introduce particle accelerator.
So particle accelerator. What is a particle accelerator?
Okay. So if you want to study what's going on deep inside matter, you need a microscope. So the resolution of the microscope, the small distances that it can see, depend on the wavelength of the radiation or whatever else it is that you're shining on the object that you're looking at. Now, if you have a very energetic particle, then this has a very short wavelength, and this enables you to resolve very small structures inside the piece of matter, the proton, the neutron, the nucleus that you're looking at. So starting, I guess in the 1940s and progressing through the 1950s, people developed more and more energetic particle accelerators so as to look closer and closer inside the structure of nuclear matter. And as I mentioned, in the 1960s, they did a crucial series of experiments at Stanford in California, which established that inside protons and neutrons, there were these apparently elementary particles called quarks.
Mm-hmm. Now, and I guess it's my understanding that the way this is done and the way the accelerator works is, and I think that the microscope metaphor is a good one. That would get people thinking about what it is really we're talking about. But in a mechanical sense, it seems to me that the metaphor that people often use is a racetrack, that what you do is you take these particles and you essentially what you have is they're spinning around and around and around and around and around. And then at some point, you slam them into one another. Is that too coarse a kind of explanation about what actually happens?
That's a pretty good description of the way that most accelerators work. The one at Stanford actually was a bit of an exception because instead of taking particles round and round in a circle, it actually just fired particles in a straight line.
Oh, okay.
And in fact, the way that that Stanford accelerator operated was very much like an old-fashioned TV set. I mean, nowadays we have all these flat screens, but the old TVs, the ones with a sort of conical bulge out the back, they basically worked like particle accelerators. You would take an electron out of an atom, and then you would accelerate it with electric fields, bend it with magnetic fields, and then it would slam into a screen, and that screen would produce the picture that we would see. And the old way of doing particle accelerator experiments was rather similar. We would accelerate the particle either in a straight line, as at Stanford, or in a circle, as you were describing, which is the way most accelerators work. And then we would slam the particles into some fixed target to see what it was made of. Mm-hmm. Nowadays, we do something which actually is a much more efficient way of using the energy which you've pumped into the particles. And that is, instead of extracting them and making them hit a fixed target, we have the particles circulating in opposite directions in circles, and then we collide them head on.
And is there some advantage that you gain in the design of the circle, having particles go around in a circle, as opposed to the thing that's like a gun that's a straight line?
Okay, well, if you're in a straight line, then you basically got just one chance to accelerate the particle. Right. So you have to accelerate it to the full energy as it goes along the line. Now, with the circular accelerator, it's a little bit more cunning. You have the thing going around. It's bent around by a magnetic field. And then every time it goes around, you give it a little kick and make it go a little bit faster, give it a little bit more energy. And that way, you don't need such a powerful accelerating system. Of course, you need a big circle with magnets to keep the thing in its track, but you can accelerate the thing more gradually. And eventually, particularly if you're dealing with protons, which is the particles we do at CERN, you can get up to a much higher energy.
Uh-huh. How long do you keep things spinning before you stage the collision?
Well, so far we haven't actually got our accelerator to work properly, but maybe we'll come back to that in a moment. What we were able to do back in September when we started the thing up for the first time, we were able to keep the particles going around for tens of minutes at a time until we got bored and threw them away. The design is to have them circulating perhaps for as long as 10 hours. So the plan would be to accelerate them during a period of perhaps 20 minutes, perhaps half an hour, and then just keep them circulating at their maximum energy, as I said, for something like 10 hours making collisions.
Right. And then the events that you're studying, that is, when the collision happens, and then your particles then become broken up into their constituent parts, then this particular event that you're looking at and all the pieces that are thrown off, that's a very brief thing, right? How large an event is that?
Yeah, you're right. It's a very brief thing. Perhaps I should just explain one thing. Mm-hmm. So as you go around the ring, in fact, our ring is 27 kilometers in circumference. There are four places where the particles actually collide. Mm-hmm. Most of the time, they're going around in separate vacuum tubes, but there are four places where we actually bring them into collision. So when they hit each other, it's going to be a little bit like colliding a couple of garbage cans or something, and then all the stuff comes out.
Right.
So the actual collision itself takes something of the order of, let's say, 10 to the minus 24 seconds to take place. I mean, it's an incredibly brief instant. So, of course, we can't actually see the processes taking place in that very brief instant of time. What we can see is all the stuff coming out. Mm-hmm. So it looks like a little bang, not the big bang, a sort of little bang, an explosion of stuff coming out. So then what we have is around this collision point, we have a detector, which is organized a little bit like a cylindrical onion. So as the different types of particle come out, they pass through the different layers of this onion, and each layer of the onion is optimized to detect a different type of particle. So one piece might be optimized for detecting and measuring electrons, for example. Mm-hmm. Another layer, well, that might be better suited for measuring the energies of photons, the particles of light. Another layer is designed to absorb the energies of any protons and neutrons that come out. So this detector is actually pretty big. In fact, the biggest detector, the one which people from the University of Illinois are also involved in, is almost 50 meters long, and it's something like 25 meters in diameter.
Mm-hmm.
So the collisions take place in the middle, and then the particles spray out, and then the different layers of the detector as you go out light up successively as the particles come through. And then we use computers to try to combine the signals coming from all these different layers of the cylindrical onion to try to build up some picture of what happened in that 10 to the minus 24 second instant of the collision.
Yeah. We here in the state of Illinois have a particle accelerator. It's at the Fermilab up in the northern part of the state, and where they have done this kind of work for some time.
Still doing it,
yes. And are still, we wouldn't want to make it sound like they're, because you all built the Large Hadron Collider, that they're going to shut their place down in Batavia. But then I suppose the question is, well, what can you do with your collider that the folks there at Fermilab could not do with theirs? Why did we need to build another one?
Well, perhaps we should explain that the Fermilab collider is the highest energy collider operating at the moment. Mm. So what it does is it collides beams of particles, each of which has an energy a little bit more than 1,000 times the rest mass energy of a proton. So we know from Einstein E equals mc squared that a particle with a given mass, that corresponds to a certain energy. So like I mentioned, at Fermilab, they accelerate the particles until they have just over 1,000 times their rest mass energy, and then they collide. And they've for something like 10 or 20 years now, being making the leading high-energy physics experiments. Now, the Large Hadron Collider, the LHC, that we've constructed at CERN, that's designed to operate at an energy 7 times higher. Also, it's going to, it's planned to make collisions at something like 100 times the rate of the Fermilab Collider. Mm-hmm. So eventually, when we get the thing operating properly, it's going to be a microscope that is something like 10 times more powerful, 10 times better resolution than the present Fermilab microscope. Mm-hmm. But until we get the thing working, of course, Fermilab is still going to be very much in the business of doing collider physics. And even when we do get the LHC working, of course, the Fermilab people will be doing lots of other experiments.
Yeah. Our guest in this hour of Focus 580 is Jonathan Ellis. He is a permanent staff scientist at CERN, that's the European Center for Nuclear Research in Geneva, Switzerland, and he is one of the folks there who is working on developing the Large Hadron Collider. Fully operational, will be the world's largest particle accelerator. And he's here visiting the campus to talk a little bit about the kind of work that you can do with this sort of device and the sorts of questions that he and his colleagues are interested in and how they'll use this tool to pursue the answers. Questions here on the program are welcome, 333-9455. And we do have a toll-free line good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. We do have somebody on our toll-free line. They're calling from Batavia on a cell phone, line number 4. Hello.
Yeah, I just happened to be going through Batavia up here on my way south, and I know they've got the colliders out here at Fermilab, which is I've been through there, and it's very interesting. But my question would be a couple of questions. One, the first one I would say, how is this going to be beneficial to mankind? Is it going to help us in our fight to keep the planet ozone, you know, from collapsing and all this other stuff? And secondly, would be, there was that theory that everybody said you guys might cause a black hole, which I think is nonsense. But I was just wondering my big thing is, how is it going to help mankind? Because it seems like we're spending money on a lot of things nowadays, whether it be NASA or the scientists and the government benefits. You know, I mean, I'm trying to figure out how the honest Joe, American citizen, or just a human being, how is it going to help them? Thanks. I'll get off.
Right.
Have a great day.
Well, I'm sure whenever we come to, when you talk about scientific research projects that are very big and very expensive like this, that's the question people always have. They wonder, well, what is the point to this? And would there be some practical spin-offs that will affect people's lives? Or is this something that's more about stretching the bounds of what it is we know, and it's pursuing knowledge for the sake of the pursuit of knowledge?
Well, I think these are extremely important and relevant questions, so I thank the caller for putting them. I think that the primary motivation for what we're doing is to understand better the way the universe works. So we built up a picture of the way all the visible stuff in the universe is held together, and we're now trying to extend that picture. Now, I can't tell you what our future discoveries are going to be useful for, because I don't know what the future discoveries are going to be. Right? The best way, I think, to answer your question, caller, is to say, well, all the discoveries that we've made in the past have turned out to be useful for something. Let me just give you a few examples. Mm-hmm. So you said you were driving through Batavia. I don't know if you've got a sat-nav system, GPS navigation system in your vehicle. If you do, maybe you'd like to know that the way that system works is by having atomic clocks in satellites. So the atomic clocks depend on quantum mechanics, which is one of the major discoveries of the first half of the 20th century. The signals from those clocks, they tell you where you are, but in order to calculate that and get home to your wife or whoever is waiting for you, your computer needs to incorporate the effects of Einstein's special and general theories of relativity, also discovered in the first part of the 20th century. Now, of course, when Einstein came up with that, everybody thought, well, this is extremely abstract and abstruse, and it's not going to be any use to the average Joe. But, well, it turns out that it is useful. So that's one example. Perhaps I could give you another example. In around 1930, physicists discovered that in addition to the regular particles of matter, there's something called antimatter, particles with equal and opposite properties to the known stuff. So there's an electron, there's an anti-electron called the positron. So this also seemed to be a very abstruse and irrelevant discovery. But actually, starting in the 1970s, people realized how they could use this antimatter for doing medical diagnosis. And there's a technique called positron emission tomography, which is used regularly in medical diagnosis, which uses a particular type of nucleus that emits positrons, particles of antimatter. Those particles then annihilate with electrons, and they make flashes of light, which can be picked up. And you can use this technique to figure out what is going on inside the body. So this is just another example of how a fundamental discovery of the previous generation of physicists turns out to be useful in everyday life. Now there's, I think, tens of thousands of positron emission tomography machines in hospitals all the way around the planet. So those are a couple of examples of how previous fundamental discoveries have turned out to be useful. Also, perhaps could mention that on the way to making these fundamental discoveries, we have to develop and deploy new technologies, which also turn out to be useful. And the poster child for that is the World Wide Web, which was invented at CERN just 20 years ago in order to enable scientists to communicate and share their data. And when our guys came up with it at CERN, we didn't imagine that it was going to revolutionize the way that society works. So that's just another example of how there's spin-offs of technologies in addition to applications of the new science that we discover.
The other question, and I know this is something that, you've probably ended up having to talk a lot about, are the concerns. I think some people have the concerns that something would happen in the collider that would be a problem, that it would a black hole would be collided, would appear in the collider and would suck everything into it. You know, I think people literally were very afraid that it would somehow destroy the universe.
Yeah, well, I'm not sure whether many people were really afraid. I think that there were a few scaremongers. I think probably most people were smart enough to realize that this is rubbish, right? But perhaps at least I explain why it's rubbish.
Okay.
So, yeah, we're going to be colliding particles at CERN, at the LHC, at energies much higher than has ever been done previously with a particle accelerator. But even the energies that we're going to produce are going to be very small compared to the energies of some of the particles that have been hitting the Earth for billions of years, particles in the cosmic rays. So one can easily calculate that the entire LHC experimental program has already been carried out 100,000 times by cosmic rays hitting the Earth, and we're still here. Then, of course, those cosmic rays also hitting a lot of other objects scattered around the universe, our sun, other stars, in all the galaxies throughout the universe. And these things don't go pop because something nasty is produced. In fact, the entire LHC experimental program is being carried out gazillions of times per second as we speak, and the stars keep on shining. Now, one could go into the technicalities of it, but that's the basic argument. We're not doing anything other than what nature does all the time. All we're doing is exploring a little bit of what nature does, but under controlled conditions in the laboratory so that we can see exactly the way nature does it.
Yeah. When you you stage a collision and you take your particles and you slam them together and they break apart in their constituent parts, and those little parts go flying off, and then you have your detection devices where you're looking at what those parts are. What becomes of those things? Do they eventually then just go off into the universe and join the other particles of their kind that are actually probably all out there right now?
Well, most of the particles that we produce in such collisions are actually unstable, and they eventually break up into the stable particles, which are the electrons and the protons. But there's something like a million, 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 million electrons and protons in each gram of regular matter. So the very few protons and electrons that we produce in our collisions, they just get absorbed and, you know, you wouldn't notice that they were there. Yeah. Now, there's a few other particles that we produce that are pretty interesting. There's neutrinos, for example, which are invisible particles. They don't carry electric charge. They have extremely small masses. And they just zip off. They can travel through light years of regular matter without interacting. There could also be some other new stable or nearly stable particles that we might produce at the LHC. And, well, that's actually one of my own personal research interests is going to be in watching the experimentalists try to chase those down.
And that is, I suppose, then, again, that's another answer to this question. Well, what is it that you can do with this collider that you couldn't do, for example, at Fermilab? And that is the hope is that you would end up seeing some particles that you had not seen before, one in particular. And I can do no more than name it, is something called the Higgs boson, which apparently scientists have said this thing should really exist, but they've never, not yet, have they seen it. And one of the things that perhaps you and your colleagues would be looking for is a Higgs boson.
That's right. In fact, well, the guys up at Fermilab are already looking for it. In fact, right now they're leading in the hunt for this Higgs boson, although we think as soon as we've got the LHC fired up that we're going to be able to give a definitive answer as to whether it exists. But perhaps I should just sort of back up a moment. So we discussed earlier on about the elementary particles, the electrons, the quarks. I also mentioned in passing the neutrinos. So put together, these constitute something which we call the standard model of particle physics, which describes all the visible matter in the universe. And this theory works incredibly well. It's been confronted with experiments done around the world, here in the US, Japan, Europe. It works extremely well, but as you mentioned, there is one piece that's missing, which is this infamous Higgs boson. Now, the job of the Higgs boson is to explain where the other particles get their masses from. Electrons have a small mass. The quarks inside protons and neutrons have larger masses. There are other particles with much larger masses still. The question is, where do these particles get their masses from? Why do some particles have mass, other particles not have mass? So there's a theory for this, which was proposed by a gentleman named Peter Higgs. So,
got to name it after himself.
Right. So, according to this theory, there's a sort of universal field pervading the whole of space. And associated with this field, there is a particle, and that's what we call the Higgs boson. When I say the word field, I mean, people are perhaps familiar with the idea that you have electric fields and there's a gravitational field that holds us down on the surface of the Earth and so on. So the Higgs is a little bit like those, different type of field, but let's not get terribly technical. But this field, instead of being like an electric field concentrated around electric charge or like a gravitational field concentrated around a blob of matter like the Earth, this Higgs field extends uniformly throughout the whole of space. So it's absolutely the same, absolutely everywhere. So it's pretty difficult actually to figure out whether it really exists or not. The way that you do that is to find this particle, this Higgs boson.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580 is John Ellis. He is a prominent particle physicist. He did his academic work at Cambridge. Then in 1978, he went to work at CERN, the European Center for Nuclear Research in Geneva, Switzerland. And he's here visiting the campus to talk a little bit about the work that they are going to do there, that they hope to be doing there using the Large Hadron Collider, which is the biggest particle accelerator in the world. Some testing has been done, but some small problems perhaps, and so it is not fully operational. But the hope is that maybe sometime later this year, the problems will be ironed out and you'll get going in earnest.
That's the plan, yeah. So what happened last year was that we put particles into the LHC ring. It's a big ring, 27, kilometers in circumference. Mm-hmm. And so the particles went around basically the first time we tried, which was very gratifying, very encouraging. And a lot of other tests were done in the first few days of operation. That all worked fine. However, then we did actually what was the final series of electrical tests of the magnet system. And an electric connection broke, and this caused all sorts of collateral damage, which the guys have been repairing, and also incorporating safety features so that if the same thing happens again, that it won't damage the accelerator. There was never any danger to any people, and there weren't actually any particles going around the accelerator at the time. Mm. It's just basically in an extremely embarrassing electrical fault.
All right. We have some other callers, and let's talk with him. Oh, by the way, I do also want to mention that our guest, Jonathan Ellis, will be giving a talk on the subject, Exploring the Universe with the World's Most Powerful Microscope and Telescope, and he uses microscope and telescope in a kind of a metaphorical sense, in the sense that what you can do with the collider is you can look like a microscope. You can look at things that are very small. But also in the sense of the telescope, what it can do is perhaps give you some insight into the entire cosmos and how it functions and perhaps what happened at the very early minutes of its existence. Our number here is 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. He'll be talking, by the way, on the U of I campus tonight at 7:30 in the Knight Auditorium of the Spurlock Museum. This is an event in the MillerCom series. We'll talk with some callers here. Next, someone in Bloomington, Indiana, and that's line number 4, toll-free line. Hello.
Hi. First thing I need to ask, you do use a magnetic field to accelerate the particles, right? Is that right?
Well, actually, what we do is we use the magnetic field to keep the particles going around in a circle. And then we actually accelerate the particles. We make them go faster by giving them a sort of push with an electric field. The actual acceleration process is a little bit like a surfer on the front of a wave. So we push the particles along, but the magnetic fields are just used to keep the particles going around in a circle to come back so that they can be hit by the next wave when they come around.
Oh, no. It's that wave that I don't understand, keeping the particles accelerating by means of the wave, because it seems to me that if you're using an electrical field to accelerate the particle, let's assume we have a photon, a positively charged particle, and we want to accelerate it. So we expose it to an electrical field. That the electrical field, I'm assuming, will attract the particle. That means we're accelerating it until it reaches the center of that electrical field, at which time, if it passes that center, it's going to slow down. How do you coordinate the field so that it keeps speeding the particle up instead of as soon as the particle reaches the center of the electrical field, it slows down?
Well, that's actually something quite tricky, and that was something which our accelerator engineers were really delighted when they got to work basically on the first try back last September. So, as I mentioned, you can regard the acceleration process as a little bit like surfing, where you have to be just on the front side of the wave so that the wave pushes you along. So, indeed, you're absolutely right. There's quite a tricky problem of synchronization to make sure that as the particle goes around, the wave is just behind it and pushing rather than just in front and slowing it down. And, well, that was something that our accelerator engineers were able to do already on the 10th of September. And I think we're anticipating that once we get the thing back in operation later on this year, there shouldn't be any problem giving the particles a kick in the way we want.
Thank you very much.
All right, let's
You're
talk
welcome.
Next with someone in Champaign. This would be line number 1. Hello.
Hi there. Mm-hmm. I have never taken a physics class, but I did recently read a book, The Dancing Woolly Masters, which I know is a bit dated, but was a very interesting book. And one of the things that stuck with me from that book was that the idea that you talk about particles, but they don't exist as particles. And I recall them saying something to the effect, or the author saying something about they exist as potentiations or potentials. And I wonder if, and basically the idea that you use particles, physicists use the term particles so they can talk about this with each other. And I was wondering if you could maybe talk about that a little bit, and I'll hang up and listen.
Okay, well, thanks for your question. So, indeed, the things that we call particles can be looked at in different ways. And we were talking earlier on about this Higgs field that exists throughout all of space. In fact, it's a common feature that every particle is a manifestation of a field, and that every field has these manifestations as particles. There's a sort of duality between particles and fields. I think some people sometimes sort of get hung up on the philosophical aspects of it, and I think The Dancing Woolly Masters, which I agree is a fascinating book, I think for me it gets hung up on some sort of philosophical issue that personally I don't have a problem with. So as you say, we particle physicists are perfectly happy talking about particle physics, right? We talk particles. On the other hand, some of the time we also call ourselves field theorists, and we're comfortable with that too.
All right. Well, I hope that gives somebody an answer. Let's go to another caller, someone I think here on the campus, line number two. Hello.
Yeah, hi. I'm a postdoc here on campus. Now, just listening, and you mentioned that you're going to be giving a talk that says that, okay, it's a microscope and a telescope, and I understand it's a microscope because you can study subatomic particles. But how does it, what sort of insights does it provide on the macro level? How is it like, for instance, like the telescope in the metaphorical sense?
Well, Carla, thanks very much for that question, because that was something which we were just about to get into. Mm-hmm. So what we do with the Large Hadron Collider, the LHC at CERN, is that we collide particles at incredibly high energies, energies which are several thousand times the rest energy of a proton. Now, where do these collisions take place in the universe? Well, they take place when cosmic rays hit the Earth, for example, very high energy cosmic rays. But they also occurred in the first fraction of a second of the Big Bang. In fact, if you calculate through the normal Big Bang cosmology, we reckon that with the LHC, we're going to be making collisions that were routine in the universe when it was one millionth of a millionth of a second old. So in some sense, we're able to recreate the conditions in the very early stages of the Big Bang. We're not going to recreate the Big Bang. We can't do that because the Big Bang was very, very big. We only make little bangs, but those little bangs somehow reproduce the collisions that occurred in the Big Bang. So then we're able to recreate in the laboratory what happened in the early history of the universe, and then perhaps we can answer some questions about the way in which it evolved. So let me give you a couple of examples. So we have visible matter in the universe, which we are made of, which we play with all the time. But the astronomers and the cosmologists tell us that there's also a whole bunch of invisible dark matter that nobody's ever seen. They in fact tell us that 80% of the matter in the universe is this invisible dark matter stuff. Now, there's various different ideas about what this dark matter might be. The idea which many people, including myself, favor is that it's a particular type of particle, presumably a particle that doesn't have electric charge and doesn't have nuclear interactions, a little bit like an extremely heavy neutrino, if you will. Now, one of the things that we can do with the Large Hadron Collider, the LHC, is perhaps produce particles of dark matter. Now, we're not going to be able to observe them directly in the laboratory because they don't interact. But we'll be able to reconstruct, using our detectors, what happened in the collisions and infer the existence of these dark matter particles and their properties. And in this way, I think we could make a fantastic bridge between the dark matter that the astronomers tell us has to exist and what's going on in the laboratory. So that's one example. Another example I might mention is we know the universe contains matter that you and I are made of. Now, in principle, there's also this thing called antimatter, but the universe doesn't seem to contain large amounts of antimatter. Where did all the antimatter go? Why is it that matter dominates over antimatter? Now, we think this can be explained by the properties of particles, and there's, in fact, a dedicated experiment at the Large Hadron Collider, which is going to look at the detailed properties of matter particles, compare them with the antimatter particles, try to understand the difference, and maybe provide some clues as to how the matter won out over the antimatter in the universe.
Does that get at your question, caller? You want to follow up?
Yeah, that's great. Thank you very much.
All right, thank you.
You're welcome.
We have about 10 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. Again, our guest is Jonathan Ellis. He's permanent staff scientist at CERN, the European Center for Nuclear Research in Geneva, Switzerland. He's here visiting the campus to talk about the research work that he and his colleagues are involved in and to talk about the Large Hadron Collider, the world's largest particle accelerator that has been constructed there at CERN, and they hope will be fully operational maybe later on this year. Questions are welcome, 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. I suppose I have often talked with people about the business of particle physics and what happens in an accelerator and tried to wrap my mind around some of these things. You know, one of the things that I guess I continue to wonder about is, again, if you'll forgive, maybe this is a kind of a tortured metaphor. I think of the business of the accelerator and what you do is something like, say, for example, you have a watch and you think to yourself, I wonder how this works. I wonder what it's made of. And you proceed to smash it with a hammer and then sort through the pieces. And I suppose that would indeed tell you something about how it was constructed. But I also wonder whether in the process you might not end up with something that would not naturally exist had you not hit it with the hammer. I mean, could it be that some of the particles that are created might be things that actually don't – is it actually possible you could create something that does not exist in nature?
Well, some particles are stable. Some particles are unstable. So electrons and protons, for example, are stable. Neutrons are almost stable. And those make up all the visible stuff in the universe. Now, we know that cosmic rays, for example, with their very high energies bombarding the Earth, produce all sorts of other particles, heavier particles, that are unstable. Now, you could ask yourself, if you're a philosopher, whether these things are real or not. From the point of view of a particle physicist, they're just as important and real as the stable particles. The only thing that distinguishes them is that one is heavier than the other, and the heavier ones find it possible to break up into the lighter ones, whereas the lighter ones are kind of stuck. They don't have anything lighter to break up into. Now, in addition to these unstable particles that you can make in cosmic ray collisions, there may also be stable ones that we don't know about yet. So one example is these dark matter particles that we were talking about earlier on.
So if you forgive me, I'm still trying to understand as much as I can what happens here. So say, for example, that you do create dark matter particles in your accelerator. Are they just going to go out and join the rest of the dark matter in the universe once you're done?
Yep, that's right. So there's a lot of these dark matter particles around, right?
Yeah.
So if you take a one-liter bottle of water, then on average you can reckon that, according to the sort of theory I'm talking about, this would contain one particle of dark matter. Now, it contains a hell of a lot more, you know, particles of regular matter. And so it's actually extremely difficult to actually prove that there is this dark matter particle in there, also because the dark matter particle is zipping around the galaxy at a significant fraction of the velocity of light. But there are dedicated experiments in underground laboratories, one of which, for example, Fermilab is participating in up in Minnesota, where they're trying to look for the interactions of these dark matter particles with ordinary matter in carefully controlled conditions so that you can tell what's going on. So in fact, there's a bit of a horse race between we at the LHC trying to produce directly these dark matter particles and the guys up in Minnesota and other underground laboratories around the world trying to observe directly this astrophysical dark matter. And I think the real excitement will be when we put our findings together and compare them and see whether we can come up with a real theory as to how this dark matter works.
Yeah. One other question then. When you stage your collision and things break apart into and throw off, the various pieces get thrown off, those pieces that were all hooked up before, once you have broken them apart, then do some of them in a sense go looking for the other parts again and reform into what they were before the collision occurred?
Yeah, that's right. This idea that we are somehow breaking up the proton into smaller pieces is indeed, as you described, not exactly the whole story. Mm-hmm. So what we do is we collide, for example, two protons. And these protons contain quarks and the particles that hold them together. So then perhaps two quarks hit each other head-on and they scatter off at extremely large angles. Now, nobody's ever seen a free quark, and there's very good theoretical reasons for thinking that free quarks never exist. They always have to be held inside either a proton or a neutron or some other type of elementary particle. So indeed, what has to happen is that as these quarks make their way out, they have to clothe themselves and hide themselves with other quarks or antiquarks to make up conventional particles, the sorts of things like protons and neutrons. Hmm.
So that they will reassemble themselves or find some way to come back together in the way that they were before the collision occurred?
Yeah, what happens is that with the extremely high energies that we have in these colliders, that you can make extra quarks and antiquarks in addition to the ones that were in some sense present in the proton to start off with, and that then these quarks combine themselves to make protons, or the quarks combine with antiquarks to form unstable particles that we call mesons, which then subsequently decay.
All right. Let's talk to another caller here, Champagne, in line number one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
In addition to the theoretical constructs of dark matter and antimatter and why there's not as much antimatter, could you also discuss or is there a theoretical basis for dark energy, and is any of the LHC research likely to have the potential of throwing light on the whole idea of dark energy? And I'll just hang up and listen. Thank you.
Okay. Well, thank you, caller. Indeed, as you say, the astronomers and the cosmologists tell us that something like two-thirds of the energy in the universe is actually invisible dark energy that's not associated with particles at all. Earlier on, we were talking about the visible matter. We were talking about the dark matter. I said that dark matter is perhaps five times as much as the visible matter. But the dark energy is even more than that, perhaps, you know, three times as much as the dark matter in terms of its energy density. So this is energy which is just in empty space, not associated with any particle at all. Now, what could this be? Well, we were talking earlier on about the Higgs boson and the associated Higgs field. In fact, the Higgs field is a prototype for how you can have energy in empty space, not associated directly with any particles. And in fact, our standard Higgs theory would predict the existence of dark energy. Unfortunately, the magnitude of dark energy that it predicts is way off by something like 60 orders of magnitude. So there's something missing in the theory. Now, what I hope is that by observing the Higgs boson and understanding better the way in which this Higgs field works, if indeed it exists and if indeed it does work the way that we think it does, then we're going to get some insights into the nature of dark energy. We're not going to solve the whole problem with the LHC, but I think it is our only experimental avenue towards finding a solution.
One of the things I was just curious about, very, very early on, a caller raised the issue of practical applications, and I suppose one of the things that I was wondering about was what did it cost to build the collider, and how many nations contributed to the building of the collider?
So the material cost, the bits that we put in, the magnets and so on, cost about $3 billion. Then you probably have to multiply that by a factor of two for, you know, paying the salaries of the people to assemble everything and so on. There are something approaching 10,000 scientists from around the world who work at CERN, including, I might mention, almost 1,500 Americans, including some from here, the University of Illinois. We have something like 80 countries, people from 80 countries involved in our research at CERN. And we're very proud of the fact that it's a place where you have Israelis working with Palestinians, Iranians working with Americans, mainland Chinese working with Taiwanese, Indians working with Pakistanis. And it's amazing how people can forget their government's political differences and work together to find the Higgs boson and dark matter. Mm.
You know, one of the things that we're coming down to about a minute or so left, but one of the things that I read somewhere about you was that you became interested in physics as a career and, in a sense, got set on the track that you're on when you were relatively young. I think when you maybe you were in your early teens?
Around 12.
Around 12. So what was it that when you were 12 years old so attracted you to the idea of studying physics?
Well, I used to read a lot of books in the public library, and they wouldn't allow me to read the adult books. I was stuck with the children's section. And the children's fiction I didn't find interesting, so I read lots of non-fiction books, particular science, and particular physics, and in particular particle physics and cosmology. And I said, well, that's the sort of stuff I wanted to do. And so I studied particle physics, and then as time went on, the connections between particle physics and cosmology grew. So now, actually, I'm doing both at the same time.
Uh-huh. And it must be when you step back to think about what when you were 12 years old, what we knew then and what it is we know now, it must be rather staggering. There's so many more things you would say, oh, but there were so many more things we would like to know. And yet, if you look at what we learned over that time, it must be considerable.
Well, back in those days, we didn't know about quarks. We had never heard of the Standard Model. We didn't know whether the Big Bang Theory was correct. There was some sort of vague idea that maybe dark matter might exist. Nobody had any clue about dark energy. So the topics that we've been discussing the past few minutes, we just didn't know anything about when I was when I got interest in the field.
Well, we're going to have to stop, but for people who are in and around Champaign-Urbana who'd like to hear more from our guest, Jonathan Ellis, you can attend his talk, Exploring the Universe with the World's Most Powerful Microscope and Telescope. That's tonight at 7:30 at the Knight Auditorium in the Spurlock Museum on the U of I campus. It's part of the MillerCom series. Our guest, Jonathan Ellis, is permanent staff scientist at the European Center for Nuclear Research in Geneva, Switzerland. Thank you very much for being here.
My pleasure. Thank you.